This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, why the Coral Sea Cable is no magic solution to the Pacific's internet connectivity problems. In a rare show of solidarity, communities along Papua New Guinea's Sepik River unite to fight plans to open a gold and copper mine. And volunteers wanted as the UN calls for public help in spreading truth, not misinformation, about COVID-19. Those stories to come, but first, pressure is mounting on World Rugby to deliver the findings of an investigation into the disgraced chairman of the Fiji Rugby Union, Francis Keane. Already known as a convicted killer, he recently stepped down from the World Rugby Council amid accusations of homophobia, linked to secret recordings of him berating prison officers and ordering them to carry out acts of brutality on inmates and fellow wardens. Francis Keane is also Fiji's Commissioner of Prisons and the brother-in-law of Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama. One of his accusers has told Pacific Beat it's vital World Rugby conduct a thorough investigation because he claims nothing will happen in Fiji. And to add to the pressure on the world ruling body, the man who led the Flying Fijians to the last two Rugby World Cups has told Pacific Beat that Francis Keane interferes directly in the running of the game in the country at almost every level. This secret recording of Francis Keane, which Pacific Beat has independently verified, first came to light during a Facebook Live transmission late last year. Keane's general tone is aggressive and frequently homophobic as he berates prison officers and orders them to carry out brutal instructions.
Walking or running? I don't want people walking. They should be running. The MFs, boots and trousers. Is that clear? You effing ass. We're not breeding poopters and weaklings here. Get tough on those two senior cadets. They are behaving like poofters to me. Take him out one day for some beers, and when he is drunk, beat the crap out of this MF. That's the technique we use. You never heard that from me, okay?
The recording was made by prison officer Hendrik de Wachter, who is now in Australia seeking asylum. At the time, he says his intention was not to expose his boss.
I use the recordings for work purposes because when I'd normally go into his office to receive all the commands that you'd give, because he was so abusive and he didn't want to repeat himself, I just took in my phone and turned on my voice recording app to record all that he had to say and then later reference back to it so that I could jot down the commands that he wanted me to have executed. Because if I did not execute one of the commands, all hell would break loose for all of us.
But once the recording was made, it was ammunition to go public with allegations about Francis Keane's methods of running the prison service. And when two opposition MPs were given jail sentences, Hendrik de Wachter claims Keane gave out special instructions.
The opposition members were coming in and he would give in verbal commands to treat them more like animals, because going against the current government, the commissioner told us at the time to make their stay in prison like a really bad one. So they were isolated away from other prisoners and the way they were treated and all, it was just not within the UN minimum standards of treatment of inmates.
These allegations have since surfaced in the international media. However, in Fiji, not only has no action been taken to investigate the claims, but Keane continues to hold his position as both Commissioner of Prisons and Chairman of the Rugby Union. As Fiji's representative on the World Rugby Council, he was in the running to join the powerful executive committee until his prison record came to light. Keane was convicted of manslaughter after being charged with murder after a fatal assault on a guest at a wedding on New Year's Eve 2006. The guest was salesman John Whippy, uncle of the groom Samuel Whippy, who married Ataga Bainimarama, the Prime Minister's daughter. Keane, who also happens to be the Prime Minister's brother-in-law, was sentenced to 18 months but served just a week. However, the history of his conviction, coupled with fresh accusations of homophobia, prompted an outcry in the rugby union world. And not least because the FRU through Keane were supporting former England captain Sir Bill Beaumont's ultimately successful bid to secure another term as World Rugby chairman. An investigation was launched, but before any findings were made public, Keane resigned. However, reports that he'd also stood down from his role at the head of the FRU proved to be incorrect. And now his conduct in that role is also under scrutiny, with former Flying Fijians coach John McKee telling Pacific Beat that Keane had an undue influence on every level of the game below the national team. McKee, who was also the FRU's head of high performance, describes his own relationship with Keane as a strange one.
Apart from board meetings, 3 or 4 times a year, very little dealing with them at all. It's bizarre. While he was chairman probably for 5 years, I reckon I had 3 one-on-one meetings with him. You'd expect some sort of relationship. Yeah, there's no relationship there.
McKee says Keane wanted the best players in his prison wardens team, and if he didn't get them, the repercussions for those players could be serious.
I never got interference at the Flying Fijian selection, but there was certainly interference at 20s level, Drew at the NRC level, because there's a lot of employment there through the wardens, because they'd want their teams to play well. They'd employ a lot of rugby players. And I know 18-year-olds who were offered to join the wardens didn't want to. They never applied to join the wardens. They get a letter saying report to for your induction. And there's a few players that said, no, I don't want to do that. And they were certainly ostracized and pushed out of academy programs, pushed out of under 20s, pushed out of the Drua. So it affected their career and their progress.
In order for Keane to be able to sit on the World Rugby Council in the first place, the FRU's governance had to be signed off. But one source who was close to the union at the time has told Pacific Beat that in his view, the first stage of that process at least was far from stringent, and that World Rugby may have been too hasty in handing Fiji a vote at the top table. But in light of the claims being made against Keane in his role as Commissioner of Prisons, Hendrik de Wachter says World Rugby have to dig deep and act on their findings.
If not followed through by World Rugby and have like a thorough board of inquiry conducted, these homophobic allegations held against him and all these investigations will just be put underneath a carpet. Locally, back at home in Fiji, nothing will be done.
However, World Rugby continue to be guarded about the state of their investigation, with Head of Communications Dominic Rumbles telling Pacific Beat, initial inquiries are ongoing and we will be publishing an update in due course. However, Mr. Rumbles has declined to tell us when that update might be delivered or who is leading the investigation. Back in Fiji, opposition leader and former Flying Fijian player himself, Sitiveni Rambuka, had pledged to pursue the government over the Keane affair. But now that Mr. Rambuka and his Sodelpa party have been suspended, that task has fallen to the National Federation Party leader, Biman Prasad.
We expect the government to address this issue, which is now an international issue. We expect government to hold to what it preaches, you know, with respect to good governance, transparency and accountability, and the merit on which, you know, people are appointed, especially if they're appointed in senior positions like Mr. Francis Keane. So we expect government to deal with those.
But based on his experience as Keane's senior staff officer, Hendrik de Wachter believes that in Fiji at least, the man is untouchable.
I was with him for 2 years. I've seen how the Prime Minister is to him. There's been a lot of stuff coming up, a lot of people treated unfairly. Complaints have been going to the Prime Minister's office and whatnot. Nothing has been done. So with him still being the chairman and whatnot, we really can't say much. And for an ex-convict to take on the position as Commissioner of Corrections, we just really can't justify as to how something can happen.
And Professor Prasad says the fact that the accusations against Francis Keane took several months to reach the ears of the power brokers at World Rugby is testament to a local media that is not prepared to take the story on.
With the exception of one or two media organizations, we have a very rigid, very fearful media environment. We have two media organizations who have always been pro-government, and so you don't expect media to pick up on some of these sensitive issues, and especially, you know, allegations against people who hold positions of power in this country.
While Keane stands accused of deliberately damaging the careers of young rugby players who refuse to join his warden's team, Hendrik de Wachter says his influence over anyone, player or not, who seeks to leave the service also runs deep.
I had other few mates that had left and were finding it hard to find jobs in other government departments because the connections that they all have in all other government departments and the stories he would spread about you. Once your application goes in, your information is already with whatever department you're applying to, and they just put your application into the shredder. Military personnel are all in top jobs and all other department heads in all other relevant authorities like the Ministry of Labour or the police. So it will be no use reporting whatever he's been doing to us because it will come back to him and then he'll come down hard on us.
And while Keane remains at the helm of the FRU, Pacific Beat has been told that his influence is damaging the growth of the game in Fiji. Our source suggests many businesses don't want to be involved around sponsorship or supporting programmes because they can't support the current management of the union. The suggestion is that for the progress of the game, there needs to be a governance and management shift. And Biman Prasad says that's where World Rugby should step up to the plate with a thorough inquiry and positive action.
Exactly right. And everyone around the world, especially lovers of rugby and those who are concerned about good governance, transparency and accountability and the fitness of people, you know, who run these international organizations, have to take this matter seriously. And we would expect World Rugby to come out very clearly, openly and in a transparent manner as to what they have found out and what they are planning to do about it. If they're not doing it, then it reflects very, very poorly on them.
In compiling this report, Pacific Beach has made several attempts to contact both Francis Keane and the Fijian government seeking interviews and comment. Up to now, we are yet to receive a response of any sort. Meanwhile, Hendrik de Wachter continues his quest to secure protection from the Australian government, fearful of the repercussions if he is forced to return to Fiji.
Back home, someone who talks bad about the government will be taken to task for sure. So if I tend to return, I really can't say much as to what will happen to me and my family.
Hendrik de Wachter, former prison officer in Fiji, but now seeking asylum here in Australia. It's been 4 months since the Australian-funded Coral Sea Cable was switched on. It was meant to bring faster internet to Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. But customers are still waiting for those promised benefits, with the rollout in PNG held up by internet companies refusing to switch over because of a pricing stoush. In Solomon Islands, the rollout has been much smoother, but as Evan Masuka reports, it may still take many years before the full benefits of the new cable are passed on to the public.
The Chicago Bulls pick Michael Jordan. Here's Jordan down the middle, all the way!
It's weekend in Honiara, and Uriel Matinani is catching up on his favorite documentary on Netflix.
I used to be following the documentary series with Michael Jordan on Sunday, which is Monday our time. On a weekend like this, I'll just ask my wife, what do you want to watch? Just browse. But when she's asleep, I'll go back to my documentary because I like watching documentaries.
A year ago, this wouldn't have been possible, but thanks to the Coral Sea Cable, he and other mobile phone users in the capital now have access to faster internet.
The Coral Sea Cable will have an amazing transformational impact on the government and people of Solomon Islands, who for, you know, their entire existence have not had access to the kind of high-speed, high-capacity, reliable and cost-effective internet access that they'll get through this cable.
It's been 4 months since the undersea internet cable, funded mostly by Australia, was switched on. And once it was, the idea was that telecommunication companies would switch away from expensive satellite internet to the better quality and cheaper fiber optic connection. And prices for customers would also go down. Hagai Arumai is Solomon Islands' acting telecommunications commissioner.
It will not have a massive change at the moment. I mean, it's gradually.
Internet from the Coral Sea Cable is sold by a wholesaler to the country's internet providers. Mr. Arumai say the price at no more than several hundred US dollars per month is low to draw companies away from the thousands spent on satellite data.
The operators, they have contracts with the satellite companies up to 2021-22, so they honor that agreement first. So we won't expect so much impact on the pricing reduction.
All four internet providers have hooked up to the cable, but so far only the largest operator, Telecom, has put its mobile phone service in Honiara, Auki and Noro onto the cable. This is how Mr. Matanani is able to watch Netflix and use social media, but Telecom's other services like broadband still rely on satellite. Mr. Arumai says the transition to the cable is expensive, and for some telecommunication companies, it will still take time. But the longer it takes, the more customers will be out of pocket.
We don't expect to be cheaper in the shorter term, but maybe in the long run, when all the traffic goes into this cable from all the operators, when they sort of ended the contract with the satellites. So hopefully in 2 years or 3 years' time.
Dr. Amanda Watson is a research fellow at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University and a specialist in mobile telecommunications. she's noticed the digital divide.
I have a couple of other assistants who are in Honiara who are also doing mobile internet speed tests for me on their smartphones. And generally that seems to be better than the research assistant who's located in Malaita province.
Dr. Watson says ever since the Coral Sea Cable project was announced, there's been growing anticipation about the prospects of a better service.
There was much discussion about whether internet reliability and speed would be improved and prices would decrease. But the reality is that things are a bit more complicated than that.
But the head of the Telecommunications Commission says it's not as simple as plugging into the cable. Companies also have to upgrade their transmission towers and infrastructure to handle the larger bandwidth.
We are in negotiating and enforcing that one of the big issues is that they must share the tower for to cut down the cost.
While it may take some time yet for internet prices to drop for the public, in the capital, Uriel Matanani is making the most of the 4G internet on his mobile phone.
I can activate more into my personal uses on YouTube platforms or even those other photo platforms where you can upload. It's much easier, it's faster. And I can share a bit of my own personal work on these platforms. Like last time, I had to wait a lot of time just trying to upload the thing, so I just put it off.
Honiara resident Uriel Matanani, ending that report from Evan Wasuka in the Solomon Islands capital. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. In Papua New Guinea, a campaign to stop a proposed gold and copper mine has been boosted with the support of famous House Tambaran, or spirit houses. These are the traditional centres of political and cultural power along the Sepik River. The Chinese-owned, Australian-based company Pan Ost is seeking approvals from the PNG government to build a mine on the Frida River, a tributary of the Sepik. But chiefs from 28 House Tambaran, representing 78,000 people, have signed a declaration calling for a total ban on the mine. The group Project Sepik organised the declaration, and Liam Fox has been speaking to the coordinator, Emmanuel Penny, who says it's the first time communities along the river have united in a common cause.
Before the colonization, House Tambaran were the center of the village, every village. Literally, they were the parliament houses. Decisions are made in there. Decisions are final if it comes from the House Tambaran or the spirit houses. From someone who is from outside, you would think that it's only the men that makes the decision. But a lot of processes goes in where everyone, women, children, young people, and the men themselves all have proper consultations. And the amazing thing compared to House Tambaran, perhaps in the West, is that in the House Tambaran, they also consult the ancestors who have died and passed on. And they also consult children who are not born yet. So it's a full circle consultation where everyone is in unison to a particular decision. So that's the House Tambaran. It's the center of politics. It's the center of governance, center of art, and center of life in a village. That's why this is also significant.
The actual declaration itself, it makes a number of points. What is the main thrust?
The declaration is a coalition of the House Tambaran along the Sepik River. They have come together as a collective voice. They are the guardians who are chosen, selected to be the stewards of the place, and they should be the first people to make a call. They should say whether it's yes or no. And in the declaration, they've said it's complete ban of the Frida mine.
It's mentioned in the background paper to the declaration that these meetings in the House Tambaran were in some ways analogous to warfare. So what do you think will or could happen if this declaration is ignored by the local MPs, the ward councillors, the PNG government?
One of our main work, one of the reasons why I moved to the village to do this is to ensure that there is no civil war like in Bougainville. Everyone is just getting ready and waiting for the government to say yes, and then we will have a war. So one of our work has been to say, not yet. We need to, and I'll say it bluntly, we need to exhaust this white man's way of doing this first. Then we will come to you. So if they don't listen, there will be an uprising, and there will be, and I've always said it, but will be on their hands.
You mentioned before about how things happen in the House Tambaran, that the spirits of ancestors are consulted, also the spirits of future children. Did that happen in these cases? And did you witness that? And if so, could you describe for us what's it like, and what's it like to witness something like that?
I always think that I am a culture Papua New Guinean. I traveled the world, live 12 years away from Papua New Guinea, so I see the world differently. I believe in science and all this. But this was special in that there were some things that happened to us that were unexplainable as a team that were traveling. When they chewed the betel nut and throw things and call on the ancestors, there was some sort of eerie feeling about it. The place became special. And we as a team that were traveling, we felt changes in the way we travel. Like I was, the skipper of our boat was thinking, hey, we went there as 11 people and I feel that we have got 40 people in this outboard motor. So we had to talk to the spirits and talk to them and say, look, you're with us, but can you just not be on the boat with us? If you're a fish, go and swim. If you're a bird, fly. And give some space so that we can conserve fuel and travel.
Emmanuel Penny from Project CPIC in Papua New Guinea, and he was speaking there to Liam Fox. And finally, the longer the coronavirus pandemic drags on, the more misinformation there is out there, and especially on the most popular social media platforms. So now the United Nations has launched a counter-initiative called Verified, and the invitation is out there for people across the region to sign up and help to spread the facts about COVID-19, not fiction. Priyanka Srinivasan has been speaking to communications analyst Sanya Ruggiero at the UN office in Fiji to find out how the system works.
The UN has launched Verified as an initiative that invites the public to volunteer to counter this growing scourge of COVID-19 misinformation by sharing UN-verified science-based content. So how do we do this? We're using the term digital first responders to describe these volunteers. So absolutely anybody from all walks of life can sign up on the Verified website. It takes literally less than 2 minutes. And then you begin receiving a daily feed of verified content that you can easily share across social media and through other networks. The messages are simple, they're compelling, and most excitingly, they also include content that celebrates local acts of humanity and contributions from groups like migrants or other groups within our community, and really makes the case for global cooperation.
How can you know as a consumer of information that what you're reading is indeed verified? How can you check that?
There are a few standout points about verified content. Number one, all of the content can be distinguished by its bright yellow brandings. But secondly, and most importantly, verified content has a double black tick next to the content. We're still trying to work on how to make this completely foolproof, so to speak, because we've seen some very alarming stats. For example, YouTube tells us that last month, around 70 to 80% of content that was being searched on COVID contained wrong information. So we're working with social media platforms as well as communication platforms, Twitter, WhatsApp, Facebook, Viber, and many others to see how we can improve upon this verified content and how we can make it as easy as possible for people to understand, but also for it not to be counterfeited. That's still a work in progress.
And looking at the Pacific region, we know already that people rely a lot on networks for information. So do you believe this verified initiative could work particularly well in a Pacific context because of that?
Definitely. Facebook and other apps like WhatsApp and Viber are very popular in the Pacific, especially among youth that make up the majority of the Pacific population. We do want to encourage these people to become digital first responders in their communities. So to sign up to Verified, receive the information, and that can help them lead the narrative during this pandemic within their own communities. So we essentially want to flood Pacific online spaces with science-backed, accurate information that can work to halt this wave of misinformation. But at the same time, we need to remain very aware of the fact that there are many parts of the Pacific that do not have access to the internet or to reliable connectivity. So as in many other parts of the world, unfortunately, these tend to be groups that are already vulnerable and at risk of being left further behind. So, for example, women and girls, persons with disabilities, members of the LGBTIQ community, and older persons. Now, how do we reach these people? How can we ensure that we're reaching all of them? In these cases, we are still working in the planning phases, but what we're hoping to do is strongly engage with our incredible partners across the Pacific. So Pacific Youth Networks, grassroots NGOs, civil society networks, including also Pacific Diaspora. And we want to engage with these partners who have the resources to be able to receive the information. And we're hoping then, as part of their outreach and as part of their work out in communities, that they can then take the verified information out to these hard-to-reach areas.
That's Sania Ruggiero, communications analyst at the United Nations office in Fiji. She was speaking there to Priyanka Srinivasan. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt, and thank you very much, as always, for listening.